everything here appears as a one-way growth function, and it seems like the only thing that can happen is that the music just stops, then we end up with a lot of people who are only paper rich.
Well, at that point, they won't even be paper rich. That's the thing with paper rich is when the music stops, suddenly your piece of paper's gone.
And welcome everyone to part two of my interview with Bennett Tomlin. I'm excited about this part because we talk about Binance, as well as other systemic risks in the space in addition to Tether. In particular, we go in depth onto the topic of the DAI stablecoin. DAI is a stablecoin like Tether, and like Tether, it has a alleged backing, a safe collateral that backs the stablecoin. However, unlike Tether, the purpose and idea of DAI was to have a transparent and censorship-resistant stablecoin that couldn't be broken merely by a loss of trust. In its early days, DAI was only backed by Ether. What people would do is they would lock some Ether in a smart contract and they could print DAI. In the last couple of years, since DAI came out with a new version called Multi-Collateral DAI, the collateral backing the DAI stablecoin switched from just being Ether to other collateral types, including USDC, a third stablecoin, which also has some, let's just say, unclear backing. So in this episode, we really get into depths about these various systemic risks. We discuss what we think the space as a whole represents. There's a bit of disagreement in terms of the nature of the scam of cryptocurrency right now and the nature of the scheme of Tether. But overall, towards the end of the episode, we have a pretty fascinating discussion about what happens when the music stops. If you want to talk about anything interesting, feel free to reach out and enjoy the rest of this episode. Binance is mostly using Tethers. They have their Binance dollars as well. When you look at Binance, what do you see in terms of their relationship with various stable coins?
Binance was founded as a Tether exchange, of course, and they've always been one of the primary users of Tethers. One of the primary generators of demand for Tethers was people wanting to either trade on Binance or arbitrage against Binance and make their money on that difference. Binance itself operates a lot like Bitfinex and Tether in that they try to pretend that they have no offices, no headquarters, and no jurisdiction. So you see some of those type of similarities there. About a year ago, maybe a little bit more, Binance added their own futures trading platform. And one of the things they did there was allow for those futures to be collateralized with Tethers, so that they were basically dollar collateralized futures. Because of that, it created a whole bunch more demand for Tether, and you saw billions and billions of Tethers flowing over to the Binance wallet. I want to say there's like 17 billion or so over there right now. And so Binance itself has a lot of Tethers in their wallet. Presumably most of those are traders, but there's a lot of Tethers in that one location. However, more recently you can see Binance started working with Paxos. And Paxos helped them create Binance USD, which is now their own stablecoin. They do now allow their futures to be collateralized with Binance USD instead of Tether, and they are continually adding more Binance USD pairs. Recently, you've seen a huge increase in size for all of the major stablecoins. But what I think's been most striking is that some of the other stablecoins have been growing faster proportionally than Tether. So you've seen huge growth out of USDC and huge growth out of BUSD. Those two especially have really exploded. TrueUSD as well, ever since they got acquired by Tecterix, has also been just exploding in market cap. And so I think either what we were seeing is the effects of that bull run that recently happened, where there was all this new money entering the ecosystem, or I think perhaps what we may be seeing is the beginning of a movement by these players away from Tether and towards alternatives.
One philosophy or one angle that we hear from a lot of people in the space is that there are more stable coins because there's more excitement. There's more new money, right? Everything is doing great. NFTs are taking off. Ethereum is taking off. Binance, Bitcoin, everything is doing great. The contrary position is that things are doing great because there's an injection of all of these stablecoins, in particular Tether. That's why there's that Bitcoin untethered article, how do you distinguish which one of these might be true?
That paper is an interesting paper. I've read it, three or four times now, and I am still not convinced by its conclusions. If I remember right, the authors themselves talk about in one of the appendixes how if you change the period from like the 3-hour period they were looking at after the flows to like 1 hour or longer, you start to see the effects they noted start to deteriorate. Also, if you take out like 2 of their highest variance data points, you again start to see the effect deteriorate. I am personally not convinced of the frequent Tether narrative you'll hear from skeptics and critics that Tether is just printed without backing in order to inflate the price of BTC. Then they sell the Bitcoin and use that to back the Tethers, the circular Tether printing hypothesis. I have yet to be convinced by that, and I worry it distracts. Focusing too much on that distracts from the simple fraud of Tether. The lying about what's backing, the raiding of the reserves, the partnerships with money launderers, the fact that Bitfinex was founded by a Ponzi schemer, the fact that Tether was founded by someone arrested in a house full of child pornography. Like, for me, there are so many more clear and striking immediate issues that worrying about potentially weak relationships or things that can be difficult to parse out is missing the forest for the trees.
I agree with you with that respect, that the idea that Tether is just a big hodler of Bitcoins, and that's their end goal, is to acquire as many Bitcoins by printing Tether and buying up these Bitcoins, is likely not what's going on here. One thing that makes a lot more sense is that Tether is the casino chips that provide everyone with an exciting time at the casino, and that really the idea is to make Binance, Bitfinex, all of these offshore unregulated exchanges really exciting because everyone's a winner. The idea here isn't so much to pump up any one token. It could be to pump up a random token and then have purposeful volatility. The idea is to encourage real money to enter into the cryptocurrency ecosystem.
It's possible. It's just not necessarily convincing to me, because often when you're looking at this kind of structure, the way I like to look at it is try to first go with my confirmation bias thought, which is that Tether is acting badly and is doing a bad thing. And then my instinct is, of course, to then flip it and try to figure out what it would look like if Tether was a legitimate enterprise and was doing everything by the book. And so going back to the Griffin and Shams paper, you see these outflows from the Tether treasury that seem to either temporarily keep the cryptocurrency price from falling lower or can lead to a reversal. But if you imagine if you had a bunch of traders who had Tether, whatever, and who were deciding to buy the dip, who were deciding to move in on a new buying opportunity, you would see that exact same dynamic, the Tether's flowing out like that. And so I don't find that part necessarily convincing to me. Tether does enable all of these offshore exchanges to do their thing and to operate and for people to enter into effectively these casinos. But I think it's important to still remember that for the traders, these exchanges are still negative sum. The vast majority of traders do not make money at all when they go to these places and end up losing. I mean, in the most recent crash, it was 700,000 accounts were totally liquidated. And the fact that these exchanges make so much in fees means we know for a fact that that money is coming from somewhere. It's coming from the traders. This is a net negative sum activity for the people who choose to participate it, in the same sense that gambling is. So Tether's a casino chip in the case that it kind of acts like a dollar and lets people participate in these games. But I think it's also important to understand that just like a casino, the exchanges often have the house's edge. And many of these exchanges operate their own trading desks and stuff like that, or will be trading on their own exchanges. And so they really have the house's edge. And so going to these places using Tether, you are in no way guaranteed a return and should actually expect a loss.
If I walk into a casino, I don't think that myself and all the people in the casino are all going to walk away 20, 30, 40% richer. That is very unlikely. In the same way that if I buy a lottery ticket, I don't imagine myself and all the other people that bought the ticket in sum are going to be richer. But when you look at cryptocurrency in the last 6 months, it does appear that almost holding anything would make you not just a little bit richer, but a lot richer.
Speculative manias are a thing that exists, and they often end with 50 to 90% crashes. And what, two, 3 days ago, we saw these things that had been trading sideways for a period suddenly deflate. And we saw basically across the board 50 to 90% crashes of all these things. And so I think it's important to understand that there are very few people who successfully exit, who actually make the gains they believe they made. There are in cryptocurrency, especially during a bull market, there are a lot of paper millionaires and paper billionaires, people who seem to have all this money, but they actually don't. Either because they never cash it out, the market crashes and they lose the opportunity, they lose the funds, or they try to cash out and they realize that the liquidity doesn't exist for them to get out what they think there is. You'll see this happen a lot for certain altcoin traders, traders who are trading in low liquidity coins. They'll end up owning such a significant portion of the supply that even though the coin is up 100%, 200%, 300%, they can't actually exit at that point because to sell their tokens would then crash the price all the way back down. And so I think it's important to differentiate between apparent gains and actual gains, gains that can be used to purchase things.
Well, right, because in the case of Madoff, all of his clients were on paper doing very well. Every year, they were making 12 to 15%, typically almost always outperforming index funds, which, like a lot of economists will say, is not possible to regularly outperform an index of the particular equities that you're trading. But Madoff managed to do it for 20 years. So for his clients, they on paper made a lot of money. These traders that are on paper making a lot of money, when they try to cash out, they typically can't. One thing that was strange in this last little dip we had here was how many exchanges denied people the right to move funds out of that exchange. Is there anything you can say about that?
I mean, that's only strange if it's your first bull run in crypto. Every time the price moves down, a lot of the exchanges will either, you'll see their trading engines go down for a while, or if their trading engine stays up and is still tradable by API, you'll see lots of times their front end will go down. And in cases where the trading engine stays up and the front end stays up, often withdrawals will be shut down. There's a joke on crypto Twitter at this point that the exchanges serve basically as their own circuit breaker, that when markets start to move too fast, you'll see a few of them just shut down and then things slow down and people can get back into positions. I don't know what's going on at those exchanges when the price moves like this, but it did not surprise me that when the price was crashing, basically every exchange had problems because historically, anytime the price has crashed, basically every exchange has had problems.
People often talk about the bathtub idea of money coming in, money coming out. And in what you described right now, you're saying there's a zero-sum game, a net loss game, where traders are essentially moving their funds between each other, but the exchange takes a cut. The house is always winning.
Sure. That's generally how I'm thinking of trading in general. Now, to be clear, there are people who've made a lot of money in crypto. It's gone up by absurd percentages over the last 10 years. And there are people who have exited that and have lots of real cash. But in general, anyone who's actively trading is going to lose money, or almost anyone who's actively trading will lose money.
Well, I mean, I think it's the study shows that anyone actively day trading anything is going to be losing money, and often to the tune of, you know, 97% of people losing money and 3% making barely minimum wage. But one thing I want to hone in on is with the money coming out, it's not just exchanges taking a cut. It's also things like miners who must be paid to burn electricity and buy hardware. So not only is it the case that when you're trading, you're just moving money between you and other traders, but there's a cut from the exchanges as well as a cut from miners and, again, marketing teams, software developers, everything that keeps the space together. Unlike regular stocks that provide value, where people are paying for a service, here we don't have a similar analogy. So on the one hand, it looks like there's a huge amount of water leaving the bathtub. And on the other hand, everyone's making money. And this to me seems like the greatest mystery ever. You know, it seems like there are two realities happening at the same time.
Yes. And I think part of that is because the industry as a whole has grown I think there is legitimate growth in the cryptocurrency industry. There is more new money coming in than is going out to those who secure the network. So those who have the costs in fiat, the miners, the stakers, whatever. What it comes down to is cryptocurrency has grown. There has been more money coming in than going out. So because of that, some people have made money just due to the growth of the industry, but that those who choose to participate in the game of trading have often failed to capture that proportional gain in the size of the industry, have underperformed that effectively.
Where is the legitimate growth in the industry then? Where are the services that people are willing to pay for non-speculative reasons?
See, that's tricky because you said non-speculative. That makes it a lot harder.
Well, if you invest in Amazon, I can tell you that I buy Amazon products all the time for non-speculative reasons, and that part of that money goes to shareholders of the Amazon stock.
It's tricky in crypto because they're not stocks. You're not generally claiming a portion of future cash flows, either in reality or in effect. This is a little bit complicated by newer DeFi protocols, looking at like Maker and DAI, where Maker, in effect, has kind of a claim on burnt DAI, the stability fees and stuff that are getting paid in. And this holds true across some of the other newer token structures in DeFi and stuff. It does not hold as much for structures like Bitcoin. So you ask, where has the growth been? And that's a little tricky because a lot of the growth has been in things related to the speculation. So there has been a whole bunch of real money invested in building out better exchanges in terms of building out better custody and better products related to the trading of these assets. And so that helps to grow the industry in terms of just services available, which then helps attract more speculators, which then increases the overall size of the ecosystem. Looking then more specifically at cryptocurrency purely, I think over the last several years, we have seen improvements in how a lot of this stuff functions. And there is legitimate value being accrued to certain things, even if it's somewhat limited. So I've voiced many criticisms of Maker and DAI in my time, but like I do think there is potentially value in a censorship-resistant stablecoin, in the ability to get to take out basically these loans against these assets without a trusted third party, and to do those kind of things in this decentralized way. And so I think there is some value accruing to those. And then just by the nature of the composability on Ethereum and in DeFi in general, having those types of base pieces available makes it easier for then speculators to build more advanced mechanisms for speculation. And so I think what we're running into here is a lot of the growth in cryptocurrency is related to speculation, to trading, to these types of gains in that sense. But there is actual dollars flowing into developing those things. And so that money is funding some of the growth of the industry as a whole.
My thesis in 2018, which remains true today, is that the only use case I found in all of blockchain, crypto, whatever you want to call it, is censorship-resistant financial instruments of last resort. And that's the only way I could describe it. I think you've said very similar things to that effect.
Yeah.
The concern here is that in cryptocurrency, we made a claim, which is we're good at payments. We can help people all around the world with payments. It's a claim that MasterCard and Visa and PayPal make. When we look at those services, we don't see the level of speculation that we see here. In those services, we have billions of customers, hundreds of millions of customers, just buying things at a reasonable rate, getting good services with good infrastructure and a good revenue flow. The problem that I found was that when I looked into the actual movement of Bitcoin and movement of DAI, we don't see these sort of services being used, these actual use cases of people actualizing like payments, willing to pay for those services. What we do see is an overwhelming amount of speculation. As an example, in Bitcoin, privacy, which is a pretty basic use case if we're talking about, you know, what Bitcoin is useful for, is not really interesting to most people right now, especially in a bubble, because privacy isn't the use case. The use case is, of course, making money. And so autonomy, as another example, is not interesting to people because it's making money. So the best place to have your money is Binance. The best blockchain is the Binance Smart Chain. The best token is BNB. And that's where all the money is coming in. And so if you and I were correct in our thesis, and that's what was really attracting people to crypto, and that's where I think there's non-speculative money to be made, why is it that it's almost invisible?
So I think the issue here is a subtle equivocation, namely that the thing that provides cryptocurrency value is largely going to be its disintermediation, its censorship resistant, and its ability to serve as these resilient systems of last resort that can handle all of these other trusted third parties failing, right? However, the reason people are interested in things is generally not going to be for those if there is instead an easy way to make money. So the thing that's bringing the value may not necessarily be the thing to which you see money accrue. So Bitcoin will generally very rarely be used for payments that truly need to be censorship resistant, but Bitcoin will often be used for speculation. That doesn't mean there's no value in Bitcoin as an instrument for censorship-resistant payments. It just becomes incredibly difficult to determine what value you should prescribe to Bitcoin. And then, just the volatility of Bitcoin, its use of an instrument to speculation, where you see so much of the trading being in these highly leveraged markets that can swing erratically, can actually make it more difficult to use it as an instrument for something like censorship-resistant payments, because it is so unstable, and it is so difficult to transact with that it, again, becomes even harder to determine how well it's delivering on its value proposition.
So let's talk censorship resistance, because what can you say about the USDC that's currently backing, you know, 30 to 50% of the DAI stablecoin?
So a lot of that is in a specific type of vault on MakerDAO called a USDCA vault, which was one they specifically added for the reason you're saying. They wanted to accelerate the growth of DAI. And so to do this, they basically gave an easy way to basically one-to-one lock up your USDC and get DAI. There might have been a tiny fee associated with it, I don't remember, but it really helped explode the amount of DAI in circulation by making it really easy for traders to get USDC and then get into DAI. The problem with it is the specific type of vault design they went with for this differed from all the rest of their vaults in that it could not be liquidated. So in the case where these vaults of USDC that are backing DAI end up being worth less than the DAI that was released from them, they can lead to insolvency issues for DAI because you cannot reclaim that collateral. Further complicating this, USDC, along with most other major stablecoins, have in them ways for the issuers to freeze the tokens, to prevent the tokens from moving, to blacklist them, whatever, effectively making each of those individual tokens zero. But the way the even the newer USDC vaults that can be liquidated on DAI are still using an oracle that isn't looking at the specific coins in that vault. So every single coin in that vault could theoretically get frozen and the effective value of that vault fall to zero. But if the oracle price for USDC is still reading across as a dollar, the MakerDAO protocol has no way of knowing that it should try to recapture the collateral from that vault. And if it did try to recapture the frozen USDC collateral, it would not be successful because it's a frozen ERC-20 token. Further complicating this, there was a period during the compound craze when DAI was significantly above PEG, several cents above PEG for an extended period of time because there was so much yield being offered on compound for DAI. In order to bring DAI back to PEG, they added a new module called the PEG Stability Module, which made it even easier to convert your USDC into DAI and vice versa, which is really what accelerated the idea of USDC backing DAI, and that was all in the USDC A vault I mentioned before that can't be liquidated, which then put us in this uncomfortable position where DAI, this base asset for most of DeFi, is largely collateralized with an easily seized asset that is at an institution that is at the beck and call of any US regulator that so desires it, which for a token that wants to be the one underpinning all of this value in DeFi seems like a poor choice.
Now, what we have is 1.447 billion USDC in this PSM USDCA vault. And what you just described is that at any moment these tokens can be frozen. I think the word censored is also appropriate. Who could trigger, you know, the end of DAI?
I mean, in theory, Circle could, right? Or the U.S. government could by leaning on Circle. And it's the same. It's the same effect you see when Maker added support for Tether as collateral, is you're giving basically any institution that's able to get their hands on Tether's keys the ability to freeze that portion of your collateral. Whether or not that affects the censorship resistance of DAI depends on the governance of Maker, really, right? How much of the collateral backing DAI do they allow to become these specific assets? And so far, it's been a relatively large percentage. And it's only in the last couple of months you've seen them start to crank up the stability fees and stuff for some of those stablecoin vaults. Before that, it was really easy to convert your stablecoins into DAI. Now it's a little bit more expensive. Because I think there has been at least a little bit of a realization among Maker holders that there was this potential avenue that allowed DAI to become insolvent. And since the change to multi-collateral DAI, that now affects Maker holders, because they're the ones who get diluted in the case that there's no longer enough collateral.
And we know that that can happen because a year ago in March, during the COVID crash,
Black Thursday,
Maker was pretty substantially diluted in order to pay off the failure to recoup losses on vaults that had defaulted. There's also an interesting thing with DAI where it's backed by a lot of different tokens. Yearn Finance, are you familiar with this token?
Yeah, Yearn is a protocol that allows people to create vaults with specific strategies. So you can lock up your DAI in a vault on Yearn, and it'll be lent out across a couple different protocols or whatever in search of the highest yield. And Wi-Fi is the governance token for that protocol.
So this sounds like a really kind of cool new age idea until we think about how many things are interconnected with other things.
And that's really the fear with any of these foundational assets like DAI or anything like that, is in the case of their failure, it has these knock-on effects. Because it, and in this case, it feeds back the other way, right? Because you end up with DAI being backed by tokens that themselves depend on DAI. And so that kind of circularity can seem to work for a long time as you build up the market cap. But in the case in the Black Swan event where the price is collapsing quickly, that actually acts as a feedback mechanism which can then accelerate the collapse and cause a deeper loss of PEG and more issues with restoring it. Because like in this case, you're taking your Ether, you're locking it up for DAI, you're taking your DAI, you are then putting it in a Yearn vault so that your DAI is earning more DAI by being lent out to people who are using it to buy more Ether to convert to DAI, which they then take. And basically what you're seeing across all these DeFi is often a way to just continually lever up. You take one asset, you create another synthetic asset from that, you take that synthetic asset and you either loan it out or use it to purchase another asset, which you use to then create a synthetic asset. And you keep doing this over and over, in effect, each step along the way, increasing both your own leverage and the overall leverage of the system, which in turn then makes it much less resilient, more vulnerable to these kind of Black Thursday type crashes.
There's sort of an irony of going into the cryptocurrency space where you say, look at how broken and bad the legacy financial system is. Let's make a better world. And in doing so and being financially illiterate as I am and as most of my peers are in the space, we often reinvent the very things that we see in the legacy system and then give it a new name when things go bad. What you just described sounds a lot like CDOs and mortgage-backed securities and leveraging on housing, essentially what happened in the early 2000s up until 2008. There's a bit of irony when a industry that praises deregulation discovers how many faults there are with not having any regulation.
There's a joke that the skeptics and critics like to use, which is that cryptocurrency is speedrunning the last 2,000 years of financial regulations and basically realizing why a lot of these things exist in the first place, which is that failure to regulate certain behaviors, certain things in financial markets leads to these bad dislocations that can cause a lot of problem, not just to whatever specific thing is having the issue, but systemic problems. And that's really what the worry becomes as you build these things on top of each other and combine them together and collateralize them together.
So in this conversation, we've talked about Tether, and then we talked about other stablecoins briefly, touching them. We mentioned Binance, and I just got a ping that Tether printed $1 billion. Sorry, this is a very timely interruption to our conversation. let me start again, and if they cut me off with another billion, then we'll have to do it one more time. Yeah, we've talked about these various things. So there's issue with deregulated or unregulated exchanges working offshore. There's issue with stable coins and Tether and their backing. There's issue with DeFi products that depend on each other and that build on each other. There's issue generally with just blatant Ponzi schemes. Again, just getting away with promising high returns, people get into them and then they explode. Pump and dumps are almost the entire point of Binance at this point in terms of what's really being done on that platform. The thing is that with all of these, as you just mentioned, there's systemic risk. And so I want to kind of tie everything together. What happens on the day when someone knocks on the door of Tether and it's away with you guys, everything is frozen? Walk me through how that plays out. And I'm guessing there's going to be lots of time for all of us to cash out and buy that Lamborghini. But what do you think is going to happen?
I used to have a lot better answers to this question, but as Tether has gotten larger and the industry has changed, I have struggled a little bit more. So the first part's easy. You would see the premium for Bitcoin and Ethereum explode on any Tether exchange, because anyone holding Tether on any Tether exchange is going to immediately be moving to the next most liquid asset that they're going to be able to exit from. So they're going to be selling their Tether for Bitcoin or Ethereum at whatever price they can, because they know they can take that token and transfer it to Coinbase or wherever and get something for it.
So what you mean is that the Bitcoin price in Tethers on these exchanges will go really high for Bitcoin. So if it's 50,000, it might go up to 200,000 in a very short amount of time in Tether denominations.
Yes, and simultaneous with this, I expect you would see a lot of sell action on the other exchanges of people trying to get ahead of the people who will be exiting from the Tether exchanges. So as you see the price explode denominated in Tethers on these Tether exchanges, I expect you would start to see the price decrease on non-Tether exchanges. So you'd start to see people selling out on Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini, places like that.
And what are they selling?
They're going to be selling, I'm assuming, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe these people are true holders and will hold till the end of days. But my intuition is that hearing about the US government taking that kind of action would lead many people to immediately liquidate to fiat as fast as they possibly can.
So they're selling like Bitcoin, Ether, like top liquid, easy to move cryptos that are available on all these deregulated exchanges that they've just withdrawn from these deregulated exchanges, or maybe they already had them on Coinbase and they're just watching from the sideline of what's happening.
I think that's the group you'd see first, is the group that's already on Coinbase and Gemini start selling, because they start to hear whatever's happened to Tether, seeing it in the market, and will start trying to exit. You'll see this huge divergence as the Tether premium goes up and the value in dollars goes down. Part of the reason I said it's a lot trickier for me to answer this now is because that isn't where the story stops anymore. Tether now collateralizes all these future contracts for Bitcoin and stuff on Binance and stuff. The Bitcoin price denominated in Tethers is going to be exploding, right, as the actual value of Bitcoin plummets. And so I expect we'll see some very strange behavior in those markets, but I don't feel confident enough to say what that strange behavior will be. Further complicating things, Tether is now allegedly a meaningful percentage of the commercial paper market, and they're now having those assets seized. Further complicating things, we now have companies in the S&P 500 who hold huge amounts of Bitcoin in their treasuries and on their books.
Right.
And so as you see the real Bitcoin price decreasing, I expect you would also then see the value of companies like Tesla decreasing on the, you know, real stock exchange. Where the market goes from that point on, I have a lot more trouble deciphering. But to me, it feels as though it would likely be a a shift in the marketplace that would leave a whole bunch of businesses that exist now gone, unable to function. And I expect that operators of some of those businesses may recognize that fact during it and attempt to abscond with customer and client funds or cryptos or whatever. And so I expect it would also be a period you'd see a lot of other people taking advantage of the confusion in order for their own profit. What the total overall effect would be, I no longer have any idea. We can give a little bit of context in that when Juan Carlo, the CFO for Bitfinex and Tether, was talking to Oz Yosef of Crypto Capital Corp, he said, like, if we can't withdraw, if the Bitfinex customers can't withdraw and they get worried, the price of Bitcoin could crash to $1,000. That's what the CFO of Bitfinex and Tether said. So there is the potential that the change in the market due to the loss of Tether could be quite large and significant.
When was this said, just for context of the price of Bitcoin at the time?
That would have been in October of 2018. So price was meaningfully lower back then. 3,500 at the bottom of that bubble, and then was tracing up at that point. But I don't remember exactly what it was. But yeah, so the potential, we're talking very meaningful losses in value potentially if Tether were to get shut down.
The price of Bitcoin and Ether and maybe some other top currencies, and then of course all the others, starts to sharply go down in US dollar terms, in real US dollar terms, on regulated exchanges and maybe on the market as well. And we're talking about minutes and not hours. That's what I'm getting from you.
Yes, probably. Part of the reason I'm hesitant is because I think a lot of it depends on how the information gets out. That Tether's been shut down, Tether's been seized, or whatever. Because potentially there could be people who are closer to Tether Bitfinex who would get that information before the general public. And so you might start to see the movements in the market before you'd actually see the massive dislocation when the public finds out. And so the exact period of time depends on how exactly it were to play out.
Some people would know more than others, and they're probably going to try to keep quiet and pull out their money before others can. What about most of these like unregulated exchanges? It seems that they would pretty much go insolvent, or if not insolvent, maybe that's not the right word, that all of their clients would be furious, would have lost almost everything. And because all these contracts and all these, all the US dollars they hold are worth nothing, all the cryptos have dropped substantially, it is fair to assume that not all of these exchanges have 100% of the cryptos that they are ascribing to their clients. Is it fair to say that maybe a lot of these top exchanges just overnight vanish or just have a complete shutdown?
So I don't think most of the like top regulated exchanges would. I think Coinbase, Gemini, Kraken, Bitstamp would probably all survive it. Probably even FTX too. It's the offshore ones where I think you would see just devastation. I don't think Bit4x would, for example, survive a USDT crash or any of the other ones that are primarily USDT base paired. One, just because they would have to restructure their operations, find another stablecoin they could use, figure out how to deal with that. And two, I just imagine there'd be a significant loss in consumer faith after that kind of experience.
Although we don't know what loss in consumer faith even looks like, because we have no loss in consumer faith up until now. And you've been talking a lot, Bennett, in this conversation about reasons to lose consumer faith. All these exchanges that are unregulated, I mean, for one, let's take Binance. I'm following Binance a bit more because it is shockingly clear how big they are. They're like Tether big in terms of their systemic risk. For example, right now Ethereum does 1.5 million transactions per day on the network. Binance is doing 10 times that on the Binance Smart Chain, and for no fees. Everyone I talk to that isn't a diehard libertarian, censorship-resistant activist who's just here for money, which is most people, they say that Binance is the most logical choice, both the Binance Smart Chain and the Binance Exchange, because it's cheaper, it's faster, it's more efficient. So one way that this could go down is not even with Tether, it could just be with Binance being shut down. That could also trigger people to exit the system, and Tether could could collapse on its own weight if people trying to pull out. And then there's just all the other systemic risks. I mean, again, Ethereum could have a terrible bug and everyone loses faith in that. Bitcoin could have a horrible hard fork. There's all these different systemic risks. And the outcome isn't a little dip. It's pretty big. Let me ask you a question for the complete newbies that I'll put it in the beginning of this podcast. But is it safe right now to hold cryptocurrency of any kind?
I mean, I'm not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. I think that anyone holding cryptocurrency should hold a portion where if the entirety of it were to go to zero, your life would not be that meaningfully adversely affected, that you can easily weather losing that entire sum of money. It is possible that whatever amount you put in there will bring you huge returns and you'll make a lot of money out of it. But it is also possible that the entire amount you put in, you can never get back out. And so make sure whatever amount you put in is something where that is survivable.
What percent of people putting money in crypto do you believe are honestly putting an amount that is not going to meaningfully change their lives? Because for me, I don't see a lot of these middle-aged 1% of my holdings is in Bitcoin people. What I see is the 22-year-old that has 200% of his holdings in, I don't know, LINK token.
There's a reason I was talking pretty slowly there and trying to think through my words as I was going through it. And it's because I have encountered very few people who say, well, I'm going to allocate 5% of my overall retirement portfolio towards crypto as a nice little hedge against inflation, and perhaps just in case it'll outperform and I'll gain some extra. That's not a super common investor that I see on Twitter. But perhaps that's just because that type of investor doesn't feel the need to tweet. Perhaps that's a larger portion that I'm giving credit to. However, my experience with cryptocurrency, I have encountered a lot more who are speculators, who are doing it because they think there's the potential for, they're putting in money with the goal of life-changing returns instead of putting in an amount they can afford to lose without their life changing.
So let's tie this in then, because the big claim that I made and that I tell people is that Tether is part of the largest Ponzi in history, exceeding the size of Bernie Madoff. When it does collapse, we'll see exactly how we can define that. And the way I tie this in is that I say, well, all these exchanges are giving too many people too much returns. Those returns are coming from excess Tethers printed out of nothing. Everyone is making a cut. Everyone is keeping quiet and hodling and encouraging others to hodl because everyone is making money. A person like you, Bennett, I don't think you're making a lot of money in your skepticism. I know I'm for sure not making any money, but in your case, I doubt anyone is sponsoring you or giving you tons of money to continue to talk in these skeptical ways. If anything, you're being called a Tether truther, as though you don't believe 9/11 happened or something of that nature.
Yeah, you get a little bit of abuse being a skeptic on Twitter.
The point is that it does feel like this entire space is potentially one of the most technologically sophisticated Ponzi schemes, in that every actor is encouraging to put real money in. It's very hard to take money out. On paper, everyone's doing really, really well. The only selling point is speculation. The money we're using isn't backed by anything, and it's radically being pumped to the tune of more than Amazon or Google in terms of how much money they claim to have in reserves. Everything here appears as a one-way growth function, and it seems like the only thing that can happen is that the music just stops. Then we end up with a lot of people who are only paper rich.
Well, at that point, they won't even be paper rich. That's the thing with paper rich is when the music stops, suddenly your piece of paper's gone.
That's going to be the intro to every podcast from now on. Let's see if there's any big questions people have. Coinbase adding Tether on Coinbase Pro, I believe. What does that say to you?
I'm honestly not entirely sure how to interpret that decision. It seemed a little bit strange in light of what the New York Attorney General revealed. There's some people who theorized that Coinbase actually kind of hoped that it would help break the USDT peg and convince people to use Circle by providing like a liquid market for it. You'd see US Tether investors exiting. Other people, my honest gut guess is that Coinbase is realizing that they're going to need to build out their wallet to better integrate with the DeFi protocols and things like that. And so as part of that, they're realizing they're going to need to make it easier to trade certain DeFi assets. And Tether is an important DeFi asset. And so as part of that build out, they worked on integrating Tether and decided to offer trading in it so that they could take the trading fees off the top. My guess is that's all it comes down to, is they realized some of their customers would want Tether and they realized they could make money off of offering Tether.
Right. The simplest explanation is that there's money to be made. It's not that Coinbase strongly believes that Tether is legitimate. I'm sure that people at Coinbase can hire someone that is at least, or a group of people that is at least smarter than you, Bennett.
I hope so.
And if you are coming to these conclusions, as well as your good friend Cass, it seems that they too can arrive at similar conclusions. So then it's kind of a bit of a weird situation where they know the risk, but they want to make money. And then we have, of course, USDC growth recently, looking a lot like Tether. It used to be that they were posting these attestations, which are not audits, but at a minimum, they're some form of statement from, I believe it was 5 accounting firms in the United States. I could be wrong about that, but there was some big claim about them being very confident in what they're doing. And now these attestations have gone quiet since February. And rather than having a few million dollars injected, a few million dollars reduced, now it's just a flat line. And then 5 billion USDC gets printed, and now it's doubled. The amount of USDC coins has more than doubled since their last attestation. All of this rings of banks and hedge funds that were stuffing Bernie Madoff funds inside of their funds in order to guarantee the same returns to their clients.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with USDC right now. Their attestations have gotten significantly longer. We haven't seen the one from February. I had to work with another person on Twitter in order to find all of their attestations because the Circle page is missing one of them and the Center page is missing another one of the attestation. So to find all the attestations, you had to go to both the websites to find them all. And then there's some weird language in the attestations now about approved investments and things like that. And it has just absolutely skyrocketed over like the last couple of weeks. It's strange what's going on there, and there's a whole bunch of theories going on, but I do not have any insight into what the heck could be going on there.
And that's fair, because a lot of the times we don't have insight. We're kind of just speculating, and there's a limit to speculation. You don't want to just be sitting there and connecting the dots every which way. One thing that I think you said, which is something that I think is the easiest one-liner to convince someone that there's a good reason to be skeptical. If a person was legitimate, how would they behave? If they were illegitimate, how would they behave? And let's compare that against what we're seeing and ask, which is more likely? Is it more likely that they're legitimate and acting in the most sporadic and incredibly weird ways for someone who is legitimate? Or are they illegitimate and acting very much in line with what we would expect if they were illegitimate? And I think that's the best thing that we can do in these cases. Even in the case of Bernie Madoff, you don't know whether what exactly is happening really until it collapses, because again, the DTC number wasn't investigated by the SEC, and so no one actually saw whether there were stocks behind it. But like this Marco Polis gentleman said, that it's very unlikely that this is sort of how it would behave. For example, accountants, like a very small accounting firm in the middle of nowhere, was responsible for one of the largest hedge funds in the world. This was a kind of weird red flag that didn't make sense. And of course, returns that are much higher and so forth and so forth. So the fact that people like Bitfinex and Cass are choosing to be anonymous, do you think it makes sense that they're going in that direction? And what do you think it means for people to come out and talk about what's really going on in this space?
I think the smart thing to do when you're discussing frauds and scams, and especially potentially criminal frauds and scams, is probably to do it anonymously or pseudonymously, because it makes it harder for them to pursue you or to go after you. I kind of stumbled into skepticism because I was just trying to learn about cryptocurrency. I actually applied to a cryptocurrency hedge fund at one point back in 2017. And then as I was learning and reading and trying to understand these things, I kept bumping up against Tether. And because I'd already been writing under my real name, I just kept doing that. I don't always know that it was the best choice, but it's the one I've made.
Bennett, I cannot thank you enough for talking about these things. I've listened to a lot of your work, and it's been very eye-opening. So thank you very much for coming on the show, and I'm hoping that the people who are a bit skeptical will enjoy hearing a lot of your thoughts.
I enjoyed coming on today. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this episode with Bennett Tomlin. Please check him out on Twitter. That's at Bennett Tomlin, B-E-N-N-E-T-T. Check out his blog. It's BennettFTomlin.com. And make sure to check out the podcast that he's doing with Caspiansi. It's called Crypto Critics Corner. Very cool podcast. I've been listening to it almost every day. It's fantastic. The latest episode is about Quadriga CX, the Canadian exchange that went completely bust. The guy disappeared to India, and apparently he died there. Well, I don't know. You'll have to listen to the podcast. Anyways, stay tuned, and we'll see you guys for the next episode.